This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll hear an interview with Rhonda Copeland, one of our lawyers you'll like.
Hear how 20-some years ago, Rhonda argued and lost the key case trying to get poor women the right to federally financed abortions. Hear how that is still in the news today.
We'll hear about patterns and practices of paid FBI informants infiltrating mosques.
If you go to a mosque, the chances are there'll be an FBI informant or provocateur somewhere inside.
Stay with us.
So I understand Michael and Heidi have been in prison recently.
Yeah, Heidi and I went over to 150 Park Row, the Metropolitan Correction Facility, to visit Lynn Stewart. Heidi, what was your impression? You've been visiting Mumia. You had a chance to see how they incarcerate people right here in Manhattan. What was your impression when you and I walked into those doors?
Well, honestly, Michael, you and I had a hard time making it through. It took us 30 minutes, but I blame that more on us than the system. I thought it was actually not too difficult to process to get in to see Lynn. We spent about an hour with her.
Was your name on a list to get in?
No. Michael and I have what are called attorney secure passes, which means that we can basically go in to visit her whenever we like.
It's not like getting on a subway. I mean, you have to give them your security pass and your driver's license, fill out a questionnaire. You have to take all of your stuff and put it in a locker. They give you a key. Then they have your hand stamped with some kind of light. When you put your hand under a light, it lights up. And you have to go through one door and then another door and then another door. And each time you have to put your hand under the light.
You should know that we stand before the door and when they buzz when they want us to go in. They're monitoring everything we do. Then we get out of one door. They lock another. Then we get in an elevator. Well, we wait. An elevator comes. We get in and it takes us up to the floor. We don't have to touch anything.
A guy escorted us to the elevator. Guy was like, Haystack Calhoun. The guy must have been 7 feet tall. And Heidi and I are not that big. And I'm looking up at him and the elevator door opens. And we get into the elevator. And the guy that's running the elevator is just as big. So I kind of start laughing. And,
yeah.
And I'm looking at him and looking down.
And he starts gesticulating behind him. And I'm like, Michael, stop it. Because, of course, everything we do is being monitored on camera.
And Heidi says to me, I don't think I'm going to come with you again unless you can respect authority. Anyway, we got in to see Lynn. Lynn told us some good stories that we want to share with you. Heidi asked her how she was doing. Was she receiving any kind of mail? What kind of support she was getting? And Lynn said the following thing. She said, you know, I'm getting so much mail that they had to actually put another person in the mail room to process the mail.
One of the things Lynn did say is that she has received, as Michael said, an outpouring of letters and support, and that really means a lot to her. So Michael's going to read her mailing address, but we encourage those of you who are familiar with her case or who have met Lynn over the years, because she's spoken on so many occasions to different communities, send her a card, send her a note, let her know you're thinking of her.
You're going to write to Lynn Stewart at MCC-NY, and her prison number is, you got to write this on the envelope also, 53504-054. Repeat, 53504-054. That's at 150 Park Row, New York, New York, 10007. And if you write her there, she'll get your letter, and she'd be grateful for it.
Really glad you guys made that visit. I remember, Heidi, a few years ago, I don't recall exactly when, we covered the case of someone who was accused of burning three SUVs in an environmental crime. Give us an update on what happened. I know he got a very long sentence, and something's happened since then.
It's rare that we have good news on Law and Disorder, but last week, Jeffrey Lures, who had been sentenced to 22 years and 8 months in prison for the act of burning three SUVs in Oregon in 2001, was released. He appealed his sentence. The court reduced his term to 10 years, most of which he'd already served. He's out now. So congratulations to Jeffrey. Welcome back. Have a happy new year.
What else you have for us, Heidi?
The National Lawyers Guild actually last week issued a new report on state-level versions of the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. The report is called Beyond the ATA, How Corporate-Crafted Legislation Brands Activists as Terrorists.
The ATA is the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act.
Yes. We were pleased that Will Potter, who is really an outspoken supporter of animal rights and environmental activists, and he writes a lot and has a website called greenisthenewred.com, he said some very nice things about our report on his website. So we're thrilled about that, and we hope that the report is useful to people who are interested in seeing how basically legislation drafted by corporations, there are corporate interests that sit on the board of this group called ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. They are going around the country and states are adopting parts of their legislation. One part that has been adopted in four states is the creation of databases of individuals arrested under these new laws. Michael, it seems as though every week we ask you about what's happening with Guantanamo, but this week we have some pretty big news. What's happening?
Well, pretty big in a way. I mean, Obama, roughly a year ago, year coming up to January 21st or so, promised he would close Guantanamo in a year. He's not going to do that. There'll still be people in Guantanamo 6 months from now, and probably even longer. But they're making a big effort to actually get the people from Guantanamo from one prison to another prison. And it looks like they're going to be buying a empty prison from the state of Illinois. The federal government is buying it. And it's going to set it up as both a regular federal prison and then what they call a prison that's a level above supermax, whatever that means. And they're going to bring people from Guantanamo to that prison. The question is, who are they going to bring? Are they going to bring people who've been found innocent already by the courts or people they've cleared? Right now, they say they probably won't bring those people. Those people are still going to try and get to another country. They're going to keep them at Guantanamo, and then over whatever period of time it takes, could be 6 months, could be 2 years, those people will probably remain at Guantanamo. They are going to bring here people for federal court trials, whatever number that'll be, 20 or 30. And then they're going to bring up to 60, it sounds like to me, people for preventive detention. So you're seeing really the first time in our country, and in recent times certainly, that they've actually set up a federal prison to be a preventive detention prison. So of the groups that will be brought to that prison are going to be people for federal trials, people for preventive detention, and then are also going to use it for military commission trials. Those are the ad hoc trials that they set up after 9/11 that have not been very successful so far and that are completely illegal. So you're seeing right now essentially the claim about closing Guantanamo to be really meaningless. What Obama has done is essentially move Guantanamo to what we call Guantanamo North in Illinois, rewrapping Guantanamo, but preventive detention in Illinois is the same as preventive detention in Guantanamo, military commissions. And actually, you know, it's conceivable that the conditions may be worse, that at Guantanamo, while it's true that you can't visit people, except if you're an attorney, maybe there'll be some visiting, although I don't think so. What Congress has apparently been promised on this as a way of getting its approval, and I'm not sure they're going to approve in the end because there's restrictions on bringing any Guantanamo people to the U.S. passed by Congress, is that this will be what they call a supermax, which hasn't yet been built in the United States. So the conditions may well be worse for the people at Guantanamo.
Now, I wonder about the personnel who are going to staff this facility, because if it's beyond supermax, I can't imagine that the ordinary staffing will continue. I would think will they engage in private contractors?
We should also understand this has been sold as an employment venture, that not just for the Guantanamo people, let's say 100 are brought here from that, but the rest of the prison is also being brought by the federal government, and they estimate that 3,000 people will be employed in its staffing, reconstruction, a huge job issue. It's a good question. Who's going to be guarding the Guantanamo detainees? And what will their rights be? I mean, we've heard of descriptions already in the United States of Muslim men in the worst conditions, as bad as certainly as Guantanamo, and this may be that. So, but it just gives a lie to any kind of change at Guantanamo with a new president.
Michael, talk about what it means, maximum security prison and then a supermax. What kind of confinement are people subjected to in places like this, and how does that affect their ability to defend themselves?
Well, you're most likely talking about what they call SAMs again, which, of course, Guantanamo lawyers are already under the equivalent of SAMs. They don't call them SAMs. They're under protective orders that prohibit any kind of discussion about what's happening with their clients, what their clients are doing. Everything you hear from your client is classified. And, of course, this prison sitting in Northern Illinois will be of all kinds of restrictions on visiting, the number of hours. There'll probably be confinement of individuals in cells 24 hours a day. They'll probably be let out 1 hour a day, let out into some little closed-in exercise yard 1 hour for 1 hour. And it's going to be very difficult, not only on them mentally, on the detainees mentally, but obviously very difficult for lawyers to help prepare. Everything will be secret.
So will they be allowed to associate with other prisoners? Will they be in any kind of sensory deprivation?
It's not clear yet, Michael. I mean, I consider that obviously any kind of solitary or any kind of when you're put alone and can't communicate, that sensory deprivation. And so I assume that some people will be under those conditions.
Well, and the fact that they're suggesting it will be beyond supermax to me means that this will be the equivalent of psychological torture, which such solitary confinement is, and whatever additional measures they want to do without oversight.
Today we'll hear the second part of our Lawyers You'll Like interview with attorney Rhonda Copeland. She's a professor of law at the City University of New York and director of the school's International Human Rights Law Clinic. She's also the legal advisor to the Women's Caucus for Gender Justice. Rhonda continues to share with us her history of fighting for the rights of poor women to get federally funded abortions. That right, which she sadly lost back some 20 years ago, of course, has been in the news a lot lately again as they continue to gut the health care provisions to make sure that no poor women can get any money for abortions. Rhonda Copeland, we want to welcome you back to Law and Disorder. As people may recall, Rhonda was on our show once before. I've worked with Rhonda for many years at the center, on and off. So welcome back to Law and Disorder, Rhonda.
Thanks, Michael. It was great last time.
Yeah, we loved the interview. I even learned things that I never knew. We were ending last show with the McRae case, which was the case Rhonda argued in the Supreme Court that tried to get the federal government to pay for poor women's abortions. And Rhonda, unfortunately, not herself, but the court rejected our arguments. And, of course, still today we have a situation where poor women who seek abortions cannot get federal funding. So, Rhonda, why don't we stay on the abortion movement and women's rights movement for a moment with you and give us some broader context of that case, maybe bring it up to today a little bit, and then we'll go to some of your other really significant work.
Let me say first that I would state it differently, Michael. We didn't go to court to get Medicaid for women. We went to court to save it, because the reality between 1970, when we began to have liberalized abortion laws, and 1976 was that most states funded Medicaid, that the federal Medicaid program said that after Roe v. Wade said states could do what they wanted, all but one of the challenges to restrictive rules came out in favor of the necessity of continuing to fund, because otherwise you'd be discriminating against women based upon whether or not they carried a pregnancy to term, which was funded, or didn't. So in a sense, the reason I think that's important is that McRae has become a two-line footnote or a two-line note in textbooks today, right? And there is a certain way in which people just have accepted that Medicaid doesn't have to pay for abortions. And I want to just recall that that was an outrageous proposition in the 1970s and in 1980.
Yeah, I didn't even realize that all these states were actually funding poor women's abortions through Medicaid at the time.
And many
so it was not
are.
Just obtaining right. the right, as you correctly
right.
pointed out.
It was
out.
Saving.
It was really
we
saving a
save
right
it.
That we all assumed we had, right.
and then are now deprived of.
Exactly. So, and that's very important because some of us have not given up on the idea that we're going to get it back. There's a 30 years is enough campaign. It's, you know, it's 30 years from the Hyde Amendment in.
Well, Rhonda, I've never known you to give up on anything.
I know, Michael.
I mean, but it's good. No, which is the
but
a great aspect about you.
There's a movement out there right. who doesn't want to give up because I think alone
sure
one
be,
cannot
you know,
do anything.
You know, okay.
But I just want to say that because it's very important. You know, the more these terrible precedents come down, the more people absorb them as culture as opposed to as bad and as needing to be reversed. So that's one thing.
Really
the other
important.
Thing I want to say about this is that I felt like the last time we didn't quite get the chance to put it in, you know, in a sort of larger political perspective. And I think this is a couple of things that are relevant to today. One is that historically, based on race and class, women have been differently treated in terms of their reproductive rights. So when the original anti-abortion laws started to come into the law in the United States, what was it about? It was about primarily wanting to be sure that the WASP population, the white population of the U.S., would not be out-reproduced by the immigrant population, and the way to do that was to cut back on abortion. It also had reasons to, like, eliminate the lay healers who did the abortions.
Right.
And the anti-abortion law was to – the original purposes were to increase reproduction among the elite.
I didn't realize
right?
this at all.
It was also to get rid of those women lay healers who were really taking care of – abortion was a very central part of the healers' work. And because of that, they also became, in a sense, the doctors for women, right? And the doctors made themselves professional. They were working to become professional in the mid-19th century, and they had to get rid of this. So if you took away abortion, if you made that criminal, then you took away this very significant connection between women needing medical care and who was providing it. There was a little bit of human life stuff then, but it wasn't significant, and the church didn't think it was significant until 1875, the Catholic Church. So the point is that even our original abortion laws were class-based, right? And then you come into other periods with the early 20th century, and you have class-based eugenic laws, right? You have Buck v. Bell, and you have the class-based sterilization laws, which said, you know, you sterilize, you know, those who are socially inappropriate, right? And that was a very broad category. That was then the fact that was still going on in the 70s was rediscovered when it was realized that poor women were being told, who are on welfare, were being told that they would lose their welfare if they bore another child. There were the two young black girls who were put in the who hid in the closet to avoid being sterilized.
I remember
this. There was a
Puerto
Rican sterilization program that was testing sterilization. And so you had all of these things that were sort of, at that point, directed at poor people so that they wouldn't. Right. So then along comes abortion as a right with at which time. Oh, and I might say that the class thing continued with regard to sterilization because you couldn't get a legal sterilization in most parts of this country before Roe v. Wade if you didn't meet the rule of 120. And the rule of 120 meant that your age times your number of children had to be 120. So if you were 30 years old, you had to have four children.
But you've said something about it being class-based and, of course, wanting white people to have more children and, you know, minorities, immigrants, et cetera, to have less.
Right.
But under the case you lost, McRae,
exactly.
It's the opposite.
Right,
because
exactly.
because that's depriving poor women of abortion. So you would think if they are worried about being outnumbered by poor people or minorities, that they would say,
exactly.
have all the abortions you want. In fact, we'll pay for them and we'll give you a house if you do it.
You got it. So what is it that twisted that history in ways that seem irrational? And I think the basic thing that did that was religion, right? It was the religious opposition to abortion. And the Catholic Church issued in the mid-70s, a pastoral plan for pro-life activities. And what they said in that was their goal was a human life amendment, but which meant a complete prohibition on abortion. But they had to take it little by little. And the first little, of course, is who? The most powerless, right? The poor women who are dependent on, quote, taxpayer money, right? So for the purposes of their religious goals, right? Even though there's a lot of evidence that the church went along with family planning in poor neighborhoods in the 60s because it had a population reduction role, when you get to the abortion issue, they put the religious, the politico-religious goal of eliminating abortion ahead of the population goals. And then what you get is this immense mobilization to stop Medicaid funding for poor women for abortions. And it was a fundamentally religious mobilization. All of the literature was religious. The debates in Congress were religious. It was supported, as were many candidates and other laws that were being passed within the churches on Sundays. The money for example, in New York, I mean, people gave us stuff during McRae, which was just fascinating, like the money for the New York State Right to Life Committee came from the coffers on Sundays. So then in 1978, you had a historic coming together, which had never happened before in this country in the same way, of the Catholic Church and the Protestant evangelicals. And they came together, the right-wing Protestant evangelicals and the Catholic Church came together on the issue of abortion, right? They had slightly different approaches to it, but their goal was the same. I mean, the Protestant evangelicals were probably more set in just an total anti-woman position. The church never said it was against women. It said it was against abortion. Though women are different. Women are supposed to have different rights than men, but they weren't as vicious about women as the Protestant evangelicals. That gave the other side a political power that they've never had. That is the Republican Party today. That is Sarah Palin today. That is the federal judiciary. The article in the Times about the way
chilling.
Bush has transformed the lower federal judiciary. And if we don't win back the Supreme Court in a solid way, which we don't even have now on Roe v. Wade, we are dead, you know, in the water for many, many more years than we think. So I think that it's very important to look at the role of extremist religion in this country. And I feel that there's been a failure to do that enough by progressive forces, because the government itself has been so bad, it's given us so much work to do. But when you look at the mega churches, the power that they've had to undo the First Amendment in terms of the establishment of religion, to gain all kinds of economic advantages. For example, if you run a daycare center in a church, you don't have to follow the regulations that you have to follow if you're a secular daycare center. So one charges less and one charges more. And in fact, there are quite a bit of problems in the daycare centers run by these churches. But basically what I'm saying is that religion has an immense power over services, over what's happening, the faith-based programs, the way in which they've taken over communities and really are dictating communities that we need to look more at. I feel like what we were doing in challenging the Hyde Amendment on Establishment Clause grounds.
The Hyde Amendment was what?
The Hyde Amendment was the cutoff of Medicaid. That what we were doing when we were challenging that on the ground that it was a violation of the separation of church and state because it was based on a fundamentally religious idea and because the support in the society was fundamentally religious, that we were at the cusp of something that has grown into even a greater monster. I say that because I think it's very political to fight for poor women's rights to get abortion back, and that it's a huge political fight that we can hope that this election is at least going to reject their representatives solidly. But we're not done with them at all. But I think that they're incredibly, they've never been more powerful in this country. The Republican platform has never been more extremist than it is today, despite the fact that McCain doesn't come off as an ideologue. And so I think that the danger that started back then with that alignment is very serious today.
Yeah, really. It's chilling, Rhonda, to hear it. I know you've been at it since I've known you, actually. You had some other really significant, really earth-shaking cases at the center. And I think there's one that we still use all the time now, of course, all of them, is the Philartica case, and that's a human rights case. Why don't you give us a little bit of the background and how you and Peter Weiss really, and some others, Nancy, I think, was involved.
Peter,
Nancy, you.
Not Nancy.
Oh, Nancy, Peter, she was involved in the earlier case, right.
She was involved in
Baby Lift.
Baby Lift and Harmon.
Right. But why don't you start with telling us what's Philartica about?
Philartica is the case that is described by Harold Cole, who is now the dean of Yale Law School and who was Secretary of State, and has worked with CCR, Assistant Secretary for Human Rights. As the Brown v. Board of Education of International Human Rights, meaning that what it did was it opened the federal courts to claims based on human rights under a statute called the Alien Tort Claims Act, which provided a basis for non-citizens, to bring actions in federal court, tort actions for wrongs that violated the treaties of the United States or what is called customary international law, which is international norms that are widely adopted as obligatory and often as absolute. When we started that case, there had been no human rights cases that had been successful under the Alien Torts Claims Act. And it was a statute that was passed in 1789 with the original Judiciary Act, and it had lain fallow for a very long time, not being used, and used in a couple of instances which really were more commercial than human rights oriented. The way the case started was what happened to the plaintiffs. And that is that the plaintiffs were Dr. Joel Philartica and Dolly Philartica, both of whom are Paraguayans. Dr. Philartica was a leading dissident to the Stroessner regime, which was one of the most brutal in all of Latin America and one of the most long-lasting. And as a doctor, he ran a couple of clinics. One was in the countryside for the campesinos, and one was in Asunción, where the family lived. His son, Joelito, was taken one night by the Paraguayan police to the station, and he was tortured, and he died in the course of the torture, which I don't think they intended. They intended to torture him to punish Dr. Philartica. They dragged him over to a neighbor's house, tried to make it look as if it was a killing in heat of passion, tried to make it look like it was that he was killed by the lover of a neighbor, as if he had been with her and he came in and found them. And Peña Irala, who was the police official, called Dali Filartica, his sister, to come get his body. She didn't know she was getting his body, and she came and got his body and dragged it back to her house. And he said, "Now you have what you've been looking for." So that was what happened, and the Philartica family was amazingly courageous. They did things that many families do. Emmett Till's mother did the same thing. They put his tortured body, because it's clear he wasn't killed in flagrant delicti. They put his tortured body on the table in the house, and thousands of people walked in to witness it in the middle of one of the most brutal dictatorships. They brought a case in the local court, and they were surrounded at night by police who were clicking their rifles all night long, and they slept under their beds. And there was a continuing trauma. They arrested their lawyer. Dolly and her mother spent several nights in jail. And then one day, a letter arrives is delivered to the Philartica household by someone who worked for a U.S. corporation. And the letter has the return address of Pena. And they said, let's see what's in here. And they steamed it open, and they found that he was living in Flushing, New York. And they re-steamed it back, and they brought it. Pena lived only a few doors away. That's the one of the horrible ironies here. And they brought it back to him, and Dolly said to her father, I'm going to New York. We need to have justice. And she had a sense of needing justice. She didn't know what that would be, right? But she just wanted justice. And so she convinced him, and she came. First he was reluctant, and then he came with her. They found him. They got the Paraguayan community mobilized here. They found him selling hot dogs in Flushing Meadows. And he was arrested by the INS, and he was in the Brooklyn Navy Yard. And we got, first Peter got a call from Amnesty International saying there's a Paraguayan torturer in the Brooklyn Navy Yard. You know, is there anything we can do? And then Peter called me and said, there's a Paraguayan torturer in the Brooklyn Navy Yard. Is there anything we can do? And I said, well, you know, Peter, years ago, you were looking at this old statute that you were thinking of with various people, were thinking of using. The Allende family in Chile was thinking of using it for the U.S. involvement in the murder of, in the coup and the murder of Allende. The My Lai victims were thinking of using it, but maybe this is something we should look at. So we looked at it, and it said an alien has a claim for tort only in violation of the Law of Nations. I didn't know very much about the Law of Nations at the time, but Peter was our resident, brilliant international expert who we all thought was in the clouds until this happened. And and he said, well, torture is a violation of international law. I said, okay, so then why can't we do this case? That we should do this case. So there was actually a dispute at the center because people thought we were really, we'd lost it, you know. And we did do, I mean, we, you know, we are noted for doing things that other people think shouldn't be done. And we finally convinced everybody that we should do it. Dolly came up with her wonderful lawyer. She was seeking asylum. Her wonderful lawyer, Michael Maggio, who we all remember and love and who died last year and who is a great immigration lawyer and a great human, generous person. And he came up, and we prepared a complaint, which we filed the next day. There was no time to worry over how beautiful and adequate this complaint was. And it was served on him in the Brooklyn Navy Yard. And then we had to try to stop him from being moved out. So we went to the court, and the court was a little reluctant. You know, I really can't tell the immigration people what to do. It was the Carter administration. And so we called the head of immigration, and we said, you know, we're worried he's on a fast track, even though most people were not, and we want you to keep him here. And they actually never moved him out. We went to the Supreme Court to get him moved, to get him stayed. They couldn't give it to us, but we actually kept him. They kept him here. In the district court, the judge said, I agree that torture is probably becoming a norm of international law, but all the prior decisions are against me, so I can't rule in your favor. And at that point, he was released. He was sent home, and we appealed. And the appellate, that he got a new lawyer, who was a much better lawyer, and they made it a much more complicated case of what we call federal jurisdiction. Like, what right did Congress have to even pass this law that we are in the federal courts? Or, you know, was it just overreaching by Congress and we had no business being there? And so it was a much more sophisticated argument as we got further up. We were told we were out of our minds. And every time I've gone into court, even more recently, on a Filartica-type case, the judge says, why is a case involving, for example, a person from Algeria, a perpetrator from Algeria, a victim from Algeria that occurred in Algeria, what's it doing here, right? Same thing about Paraguay, about anywhere. Because they couldn't understand how they could have jurisdiction and over something that really didn't have these points of contact with the United States. Well, the contact is that he's here, and you can sue a person when they come here. And that's been very important to the whole line of cases that CCR has developed since Filartica. At any rate, the court had as the presiding judge was Irving Kaufman. And Irving Kaufman was the judge who sentenced the Rosenbergs to death. And every once in a while in Irving Kaufman's life, he's tried to do something very great for civil liberties. And we don't know if this is expiation or not. And I think this was perhaps one of them. But we had a very decent bench. Kaufman kept saying, what does the State Department think about this? What does the State Department think about this? And, of course, our argument was that it doesn't really matter, Judge, what the State Department thinks. You know, you are a court. You're independent of the State Department. You have to act as an independent judiciary. Well, we got back to the office, and the clerk called us that the court had asked the State Department for an opinion. So then that
now, this was the Jimmy Carter period, so we at least had some hope. Plus, I think you knew some of the people.
We knew. Peter knew some of the people who'd been there for a long time. What I only learned 2 years ago from the then and first Assistant Secretary for Human Rights, Pat Darien, was that the Latin Americanist in the State Department knew all about wanting an amicus brief and didn't tell her. So they tried to keep the Human Rights Bureau out of the subject. She got to know about it because I was called by someone from the Justice Department. They had sent it over to the Justice Department to draft the brief, and they wanted our thoughts on it. And Peter knew people in the legal advisor's office who are the longer term folks who were very progressive. And all of that conspired against what had been the State Department's view that you support these dictatorships, you don't undermine them. Right. So that was very key in terms of the timing of the case. The U.S. came out with a fantastic amicus brief. Really, it gave us everything we could have possibly wanted. And of course, so I don't want to credit Kaufman with courage here. Of course, we got a brilliant ringing opinion saying that torture is a violation of international law. It's absolutely horrendous violation, and that the Alien Tort Claims Act does validly give non-citizens a right to bring cases where you have norms of that dimension in international law. So that is what is meant by opening the door.
No, it really opened the door. I mean, both for cases in the United States where the center and other now institutions have gone on, sued all kinds of dictators as well as corporations who do this. And it's really the base almost, I mean, you could say for the Convention Against Torture, for the Pinochet case, for really making torture as something that could actually be sued on anywhere in the world.
And it was based, in a sense, on a principle, though we had a statute, it was based on a principle of universal jurisdiction, that you can't escape your wrongs by crossing national borders. And that actually was an old principle of Anglo-American law that we used very effectively in the argument to say, we have a principle, it's called transitory tort. Your wrongs stay on your back. You can't get out from under them. So if you come here, you're still suable, and you're suable in state court. And we said, you know, Judge, we don't really think you want these cases to go to state court because these are federal cases involving international issues. And so that was very helpful in, you know, how do you move a court? You move a court by appealing to their sense of power or need, as well as to whatever your rights and norms may be. And one of the things that we are doing with Filartica, with the Filartica principle and cause of action, is that we are representing immigrant domestic workers who have both international claims and domestic wage and hour tort contract claims. And these are workers who are either trafficked into forced labor. Sometimes it's sexualized, sometimes it's not. And the Alien Tort Claims Act and the Filartica principle enable us to bring those cases into federal court and to emphasize that they are international cases. And we've
But how does that happen? Aren't the people abused here? I don't understand.
Yes, they're abused here, but they're non-citizens.
Alien. Okay, so they can sue
even
though.
And they're suing for tort in violation of international law. Right. And we're waiting now on a decision in a case against the Kuwaiti mission and a Kuwaiti diplomat. Right. And we think we've cracked the sovereign
immunity
issue.
That would be incredible
issues.
If you cracked
that
it.
That will be incredible.
Because these diplomats can employ slaves,
and
they're immune.
And they do. And they will go nuts if we win this. And my colleague, Andy Fields, who's responsible for these cases, says, we've got it. We're locked up. Now, you never locked up. You know, between Andy and the students, they have actually found incredible means to get at the mission and the and this very high-level diplomat. So I want to say that, you know, the principle of international law operates, you know, Eleanor Roosevelt said, you know, it's the small things close to home, right? It operates, human rights operates at every level. It operates at the level of the Stroessner dictatorship, and it operates at the level, whether the diplomat or the individual person who's abusing, you know, an immigrant.
It's been, as usual with you, fantastic. Thank you, Rhonda.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Recently, the FBI, and particularly Director Robert Mueller, have come under fire for the practice of sending informants and others in to surveil mosques around the United States. We've known about this practice for a long time, really since the time of Ashcroft, shortly after 9/11, when they divided the whole country into sections and really told FBI agents, go mosque by mosque, get every one of them. Well, he came under fire. And then Mueller defended the practice of using informants to monitor mosques in the United States. Last month, a judge ordered the FBI to submit 100 documents detailing the Bureau's surveillance of Muslim leaders in California. This use of agent informants and provocateurs by the FBI is unfortunately the order of the day for our intelligence agencies. As a result, cases like the Liberty 7, the Fort Dix case, and the recent Memorial Day weekend alleged terror plot in upstate New York have been filed with great public hoopla, but with little, very little substance. Today we're joined by Shakil Saeed, Executive Director of the Islamic Shura Council of Southern California, to discuss, in particular, the FBI's continuous infiltration of mosques throughout the United States.
Shakil Saeed, Executive Director of the Islamic Shura Council. Thank you for joining us on Law and Disorder.
Thank you for inviting me.
Recently, the FBI director, Robert Mueller, commented and said, we don't investigate places, we investigate individuals with regard to the FBI spying of mosques. What can you say about that?
In fact, I responded to that on the record saying that either he doesn't know what's happening under his nose in his own department or he's lying.
What is happening?
What we know for fact in Southern California through ongoing surveillance of mosques, through the infiltration of provocateurs and predators in mosques, surveilling the sermons, surveilling the activities, attempts to recruit mosque members to keep an eye out on the clergy leader, the imams, and the mosque activities, approaching and intimidating and harassing students to recruit them, to spy on the clergy leaders and the lay leaders of the mosques and reporting the activities. Folks coming back from travel, being stopped at the airport, again asking the similar questions, which mosque do you go to, what activities takes place in the mosques, and so on and so forth. All of these combined contradict what Mueller says, that he does not and their department does not surveil institutions and organizations that are protected under the Constitution, but rather individuals.
Recently, the Council of Islamic Organizations sent a letter to Attorney General Eric Holder making similar complaints. Can you tell us what was the content of the letter and what was the letter requesting?
the letter insisted essentially on investigating all of these allegations that we are alleging that the FBI has been doing and is doing, and B, to create a system via which there is oversight and transparency in the activities that they undertake. Three, to share their guidelines, whatever that they are, that they claim that the constitutional rights rather than otherwise. And fourth is to go over the situation, particularly with Council of American Islamic Relations, that is not specified in any way to anyone anywhere in the country, with the exception that CARE is considered to be a suspect organization, while we all, as community members and community leaders, consider CARE to be part and parcel of the community, an integral part of the community that protects civil rights and civil liberties of Muslims and Arabs in this country.
What was the Attorney General's response to the letter?
Silence.
What, silence? Wow. This is Michael Ratner. It's really good to have you. You know, I recall, and I'm just thinking now about it, when Ashcroft was Attorney General, you know, shortly after 9/11, the FBI issued a set of guidelines, or at least not just guidelines, but also, we understood, an order that FBI agents in every district had an obligation every single month to go into and eventually visit every single mosque in some way or another and set up informants. And then, of course, there was a new set of FBI guidelines issued at the at the end of the Bush administration, which I think President Obama has allowed into effect, about using essentially ethnicity, race, religion, et cetera, to be able to spy on people. Is that part of this issue right now? I mean, this is all related, I presume.
It sure is. I mean, you know, all we are baffled at this time is there's a great deal of surplus on the political rhetoric by the current administration, and there's a great deal of deficit at the policy level. This is just an ongoing and continuum of the Bush policies. We haven't seen any difference other than just a lot of rhetoric that this will be addressed, this will be changed. And in fact, you know, what disturbs me is Mueller's insistence when he said what he said in L.A. I didn't attend that particular press conference, but when the reporters called me to respond to the statements he made where he says that we are going to escalate the activities that we undertake through informants in mosques. And the administration is absolutely quiet on that. And that disturbs me quite a bit, that this is a tacit approval of the Bush policies and the culture that seems to be becoming rather ingrained and pervasive in the agency's culture.
Shaquille, what's the right word for this? It's so outrageous. Is it racism? Is it stereotyping? What connection could possibly be made between, 15 out of the 19 people that blew up the World Trade Center were from Saudi Arabia, and now they're spying on mosques in California? It seems to me this is like a giant racist distraction.
Well, this is legal religious bigotry that unfortunately continues to happen.
You mentioned that there's no difference between what's happening now and what happened under the Bush administration. Was that because we have the same FBI director?
I think it's more than the director. I believe that there is a systemic problem with the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Individual agents whom I have had the painful privilege to talk to and interact with more in the past, I don't know, between 2001 and 2005, and since thereafter I don't speak to them. But during those conversations, they used to share that this is grandly stupid. They are just keeping us busy on doing things that has nothing to do with actual intelligence gathering and counterintelligence, counterterrorism, and so on and so forth. And they used to admit that there is a systemic problem. All we are being told by the DC is to do this, to interview people, to harass people, to interrogate them, to stop them at the airports, to visit their mosques, to visit schools, and so on and so forth. So I think that certainly the leadership plays an important role in that continuum, but I think there's a systemic problem in the agency itself. They just need a perceived enemy to keep themselves busy and keep seeking resources. In a response to the recent Mueller statement, I responded by saying he's lying, in reference to that they're not surveilling the mosques and they're only surveilling the suspects or the individuals. And I said that that's a clear lie, either a lie or he doesn't know what his department is doing.
It seems to me that there's not a whole lot of difference between investigating the way they're doing it, investigating people and investigating places. Because once you put an informant inside a building, once you tap a phone line, once you start marking down whose cars are in the parking lot, you're looking at everybody who comes onto that property or who's a part of that community.
Absolutely. I mean, all of that plus more, actually, by the admission of this provocateur. You know, I have stopped using the word informant, Dahlia, anymore. Reason being that these are not simply informing about activities. These people are provoking and entrapping innocent people.
That's right.
In places of worship. I shuffled between using the word provocateur and predator, really. What we do know from this particular provocateur who was implanted in Orange County in Southern California by the name Craig Montell.
Shaquille, some of our listeners may not have heard the earlier segment where you told this story. Can you summarize this story for everybody, please?
I mean, Craig Montell is a person who FBI paid anywhere between $2,500 to $10,000 per month for about 18 months to fish victims from mosques, according to his own statement in the court of law, between June of 2006 and October of 2007, if my memory serves right. And he was asked to prowl 6 different mosques in Orange County regularly, and he falsely pretended to become a Muslim and embraced Islam in mosque, befriended several Muslims, and then used provocative language. And when he was reported by one of the mosque members, then that mosque member was harassed by FBI, saying that your life will be a living hell. And then he was picked up on the allegation that he is part of Al-Qaeda's sleeping cell in Orange County and so on and so forth. You know, Craig Montell is an ex-convict.
Typically.
And he has conned several women, hundreds of thousands of dollars. And by his own admission, the arrangement between FBI and this individual was that you do this for us and we will expunge and, all the past.
So they picked someone who knew how to develop relationships and lie.
The extent of FBI's due diligence in finding people
extortionist.
Right. I mean, that's why I say that, you know, this is a systemic problem. And the same thing we see also, and I think you folks know more than I do, what was recently reported in New York as well and several other cases where it's serving as a provocateur and then entrapping innocent people.
The New York case is really, I mean, we covered here is extraordinary, you know, the one that took place in Westchester, upstate New York. But what was interesting, yesterday there was a statement by local FBI people saying now that they're bringing some of the Guantanamo people here, or at least a few, to try, that all their resources are going to have to be spent on those prosecutions, and they won't have time to do the regular weeding out of terrorists among us. And I just thought to myself of this complete agent provocateur who was up here visiting the mosque and engaging these 4 young men in, you know, in BS crime. I mean, it was really shocking.
Suspect strongly, and I didn't have time to do enough research, but whenever these statements are made, they are followed by demand of resources from the government. If we were to investigate and link these statements, like Mueller's statements that, you know, we will do more, we need more resources, and that's the best place to gather information and so on and so forth, I translate that as, I don't have enough money, give me more money. And I think it's something that we ought to look into closely and see if American Muslim citizens are being used and manipulated for simply generating more resources while blackballing them and while doing illegal activities on them and demonizing and dehumanizing them through these statements and activities by the agency.
I want to remind our listeners, we're speaking with Shaquille Saeed, who's the executive director of the Islamic Shura Council of Southern California. Really extraordinary what you've been telling us. Is there a way for our listeners to reach you with a website?
Yes, it's Shura Council, shura.org. The work that I do does involve a great deal of activity, interacting with public service agencies in the local area. And then we started observing that FBI is interviewing people outside, and we are getting reports. And when we go back with those reports to FBI asking what the heck is going on, answer is that it's an open investigation. We can't talk about it. And this is our mandate. This is our job. This is what we do. subsequently thereafter, I started suspecting that I'm being tailgated. Phones, I suspected my home phone, particularly the phone that I'm talking from now, was tapped on.
What made you suspicious?
What made me suspicious? Well, in the course of conversations, crackling a few times, the phone automatically dialed the local police. The local police showed up at my house, and they said, "You guys called." And we all are sane adults in this house, so we know when we are calling and not calling. Several of these things happen. And then we filed the FOIA case, not just on me, but 11 of us from Southern California. And lo and behold, we now know for fact. And again, this is directly in contradiction to what Mueller says and FBI says, that they don't surveil mosques and clergy leaders and so on. Through the FOIA, I now discover that several of my sermons were recorded. My public speaking engagements were being surveilled. I spoke against Iraq, against NCR's program that's part of the FOIA. This is after we filed the lawsuit. First, they said there is no documentation on you, but when we filed the lawsuit, then I got about 800 some odd pages on me, of which 80%, 90% are all redacted.
It's a big file for a few years.
It sure is.
I'll tell you that, because we do a lot of this work. That's not small.
And we are litigating that, trying to get that unredacted to learn where are the violations and illegal activities that FBI undertook, which obviously they are hiding under the guise of national security.
It's all very scary, but what I liked about what you've done is it really gave our listeners, I think, a learning process here of dealing with the FBI. And you know, we went through this at the center in the 80s when they were massively surveilling anti-war activists around Central America. Of course, it wasn't the same as the religious bigotry, but the FBI tactics were exactly the same. Wide dragnet surveillance. And then as soon as we would call as an attorney, they would generally 95% or more back off, because we'd say, well, you can meet us, I'll be there with my client, and they would back off. But so many people, and I think the lesson you learned, so many people didn't call us and talk to the FBI without talking to us. And I guess the lesson that you're telling all of us is you have a phone number, you have a website. When the FBI calls you, call. But you also brought out the problem of the green card problem, and we had that same problem in the 80s with the leverage that they can try and get over you because of that.
They did the same thing to the Black Civil Rights Movement in the 60s. They did the same thing to the anti-war movement. This is their MO. Now they've translated it into their latest scapegoat. The Muslim community is extraordinary, what you've been able to share with us, Syed. Thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder.
My hope as a Muslim American is in people like yourselves who stand up for our rights and who empower us, helps us. Not certainly in the government, including Obama's administration, has so far miserably failed. Very lofty words and statements, but not supported and backed up by concrete policies and actions. So it's my hope that good American people will stand up in these challenging times when most contributive and productive citizens of this country are being marginalized and demonized on a daily basis by the very public agencies that are supported by the tax dollars.
Shakil Syed, Executive Director of the Islamic Shura Council of Southern California, thank you so much for joining us and for sharing what you know all about all this.
My pleasure.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.